Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and Century Wealth Management.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Pearson Crutcher.
And I'm Jay Healy. Pearson runs the Society of Entrepreneurs. It's a membership organization founded to promote Memphis entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to business owners.
Jay Healy is the founder and president of Century Wealth Management, an entrepreneurial firm that can serve as your family's CFO. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights.
Welcome to our conversation with Jack Soden. Jack runs Elvis Presley Enterprises. This is something that he started 40 years ago with an invitation from Priscilla Presley to turn Graceland into a tourist attraction. Not only has he done that, but he has expanded the Elvis Presley influence around the world over time to achieve remarkable results. And he's going to go into detail about what that journey's been like and what Elvis Presley Enterprises has accomplished and where they are now. We hope you enjoy this interview with Jack Soden.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. I'm so excited this morning to interview Jack Soden. The year that I started at the Society of Entrepreneurs, 1999, way back when, Jack Soden was inducted. And one of my first jobs, actually, you were inducted in 1998, I think. And one of the first jobs I did for the Society was to do the press release. And I remember talking to Jack Soden, and I was so nervous. And he was so nice. He was so accommodating and so supportive. So, and it hasn't changed in all the years that I've gotten to work with you. It's just always a joy when I get to talk to Jack Soden. So I know that you all will enjoy this interview. Welcome, Jack. Thanks for being here.
Well, Pearson, thank you for that introduction. I'll try to be as nice as I can be.
Yeah, Jack, we're very excited to have this conversation.
Well, it's fun to be part, it's certainly fun to be part of the Society of Entrepreneurs. It's a great honor. And I've always, Pearson knows since I met her, I've always said, you know, I don't really belong with these guys because they're such an impressive group of Memphis business heroes.
And I think you've perfectly fit in that group. So,
and for anybody who's from Memphis or knows Memphis well, we know Jack. But for those who don't, it'd be helpful to hear your story. How did you get to Memphis? How did you get introduced to Graceland and Elvis?
Well, you know what? It needs to be a short version. The long version, of course, only my mother would want to hear.
Takes about 50 years, right?
Yeah, but the short version, as short as I can make it, is I am the most improbable story to be in Memphis doing what I had a chance to do. And basically, I was involved in investment banking in Kansas City. We called ourselves stockbrokers in those days. And in any event, I joined a friend and associate. I had a little money management account and traded, you know, options and commodities and a little mixed bag. But my partner was an interesting guy. He'd travel around the country and speak. And anyway, in L.A., speaking at a YPO group, he met a man that said, you know, I've got a friend named Priscilla Presley, recently moved to California. She has the money that came from a divorce from Elvis and could use some investment advice. So that's how I met Priscilla. My associate, unfortunately, how things twist and turn, basically died in a plane crash. That put me in closer kind of contact with Priscilla. Priscilla came to the funeral in Kansas City. We spent the afternoon together, and somehow or other, now when we sometimes reminisce, when we, Priscilla and I, reminisce now 39 years later, that we just kind of hit it off. And she had this notion. She had been in California, I think, already for a couple of years. She was kind of going, I find it hard to find people to trust, that everybody's got a line. And there was something about the Midwestern approach. And she just liked me. And so we talked about Graceland, and I gave her my optimistic view, and which was different. Once again, there's side stories to all of this, but there really wasn't a great deal of enthusiasm to open Graceland. Nobody really saw the potential. And it's not like I had this vision, but I just had the advantage of being from someplace else and thinking, you know, all my friends in Kansas City, if I mentioned, you know, this Graceland, they'd go, wow, that's really cool, you know. And but in Memphis, it was kind of prophet without honor, you know. It was like, yeah, Elvis.
At that time in Memphis, what was the state of Graceland? Was it just basically sitting empty?
Right. It wasn't empty. It's interesting, and it's part of what preserved the authenticity of Graceland. Elvis died August of 77, and he was initially buried in the mausoleum at Forest Hill Cemetery. And there was so much confusion and fans and et cetera that over the ensuing weeks and months, the Elvis's father worked to have Elvis and his mother, Gladys, moved back to a meditation garden at Graceland. And that set the stage for now the fans wanting to come to Graceland. And so in any event, I had a chance to meet Priscilla's co-executors. I was invited to kind of go visit some other famous home tours and maybe come up with a suggested business plan for Graceland, which I did. It was a great adventure. Went to Hearst Castle, Biltmore, Monticello, Mount Vernon, Graceland. I've always said along the way that it was the big five, and that was two presidents, two capitalists, and one king. So, but in any event, got lots of ideas about how to operate a tourist business. And we opened Graceland in June of 82. And I've always said over the years, there's nothing terribly instructive for young up-and-coming entrepreneurs. But the advantage I had in the summer of 82, including the executors, was practically zero expectations. In other words, it was almost impossible to fail because they didn't think it was going to work. And honestly, the guess was right, because there was something about Elvis. I mean, to this day, people old enough can tell you exactly what they were doing, where they were when they heard Elvis died. Unlike, you know, almost any other celebrity you can think of, you know Marilyn Monroe died and John Wayne died and et cetera, but you can't really remember when or what you were doing when you heard. And there was something, you know, it's transitioned. This, we're talking about the public psyche in the 80s. But they came. We used lessons we learned from Hearst Castle and from Monticello, and we opened the tour, and the most we could do in a day was 3,024, and we sold out on opening day and sold out the next day and the next day. And I can remember thinking, we did like, you know, 100,000 people within about 5 weeks, and it was, wow, here we go. This is going to be great. And the fact is, I can remember being worried going into the fall of 82 that maybe there's 300,000 people in the world that want to see Graceland and we just met them, you know, and that winter will come and this will all. And so I never remember a time, I called it, it was creative worry. I was worried all the time. Never took anything for granted. Even, you know, when we'd have a great winter and then head into spring and people are going to go other places, et cetera. So we kept, I think it was a healthy concern to never take things for granted.
Sure. So, you're planning for what if, I'm sure, that whole time, right? What was your backup plan? Did you have one?
Well, not really. You mean like a personal backup plan?
Well, yeah. I mean, was there anything that y'all were doing within the organization that what if they don't come? But that was just, you were just riding the tide.
Well, pretty quickly, I mean, even with our people, as we put together a marketing team and our operations and et cetera, I mean, I can kind of remember thinking, you know, Elvis Presley obviously left a unique legacy. And if we're not getting enough, and it's so interesting to people, the story, as I said, I mean, and it happens to this day, this very day, there are people arriving at Graceland mildly interested. And we're pretty successful at, a few hours later, having them leave wildly interested.
I agree. I've seen that happen, going with a group from the Society of Entrepreneurs of Memphians, because I know that they're probably the ones that go the least.
Of course.
But them going and then walking out going, this was amazing. It's such a great place. And he was such an incredible person.
It's nice to be able to routinely exceed expectations. You know, it's important. And so, like I say, it was pretty early on that, you know, my sense of it while I was worrying and with our people was basically, if Graceland isn't welcoming thousands of visitors and timely and timeless 10 years from now, 15 years, it'll be our fault. It's our job to make Elvis relevant and keep him timely and not to take any credit because it all goes to Elvis. I mean, there's no other celebrity that I know of that we could have had a similar, well, you know, I mean, we just passed like 22 million visitors and median age of our visitors now is younger than it was 15, 20 years ago.
So even new generations are
Elvis
fans.
New generations.
It's not even just the people that knew him when they were growing up. Wow, that's really neat.
Yeah, you have to be prepared to feel old when you ask. You know, I love to ask people, you know, like you're here and to see a 23-year-old girl in Elvis t-shirt and a big fan and, you know, how did you become, what was your discovery point? When did you become? And the reason I say you have to be prepared to, because very often it's my grandmother was a big fan and, you know, and played the music all the time. So, but we've had rediscovery and regeneration in our sights literally every step of the way.
That's incredible. What would you say, how many people work at Graceland?
Well, there's the answer in 2018, 19, and, you know,
right.
And there's a different answer right now.
I'm sure of that.
But basically, kind of pre-COVID and hopefully post-COVID, Graceland is labor-intensive. It's about 300 with a mix of seasonal and part-time, and another 220 for our new hotel, 450-room hotel.
Yeah, that's great. I was curious, though, are most of them real Elvis fans? I mean, did they come in and they're like, I want to do this because I love Elvis, or is it a new group of...
Well,
up-and-coming new Elvis fans.
It's, you know, it's a little bit of everything. But we have a lot of employees. Well, frankly, we have a lot of employees who live in our zip code in Whitehaven because we're a good job, a fun job. Hopefully it's fun for them, and it is easy to get to.
Well, that new hotel is incredible. It's a beautiful and great addition to the neighborhood, I'm sure.
The hotel, you know, the hotel was on my wish list for like 25 years. And it's interesting that what we ended up building exceeded earlier expectations. It really, really turned out, we're really pleased with it. And people tend to be impressed with it.
So tell us about the wish list. I hear that you're still checking boxes on that list.
Well, yeah. When I go back and I think about, because I'll find wish lists from way back, things like notes that I heard Elvis had this giant airplane. Where is it? Go find it. It'd be fun to get it back.
The Lisa Marie.
Yeah. And they're all funny stories. I mean, the plane had been changed owners. It was owned by Raymond Zimmerman, the founder of Service Merchandise, kind of a forerunner of Costco, who bought it. He was going to fly it around to stores and he got the first month's fuel bill and parked it.
And, I bet.
But negotiating with him to buy the plane back was just a hoot. It was one of the more fun. He was just a character, in other words. It all boiled down to, he said I had to pay him an amount of money that wouldn't embarrass him with his golf buddies. And so what if we make up a number? Anyhow. There's funny stories on all that. But the fact is, yeah, and hotel was on an early, early list. And of course, we actually, the first hotel that we bought, Kimmins Wilson built a Wilson World next door to us. And ultimately,
I remember that.
Yeah, and then ultimately the boys talked to Kimmins kind of out of it. And we bought it from them and kind of rethemed it and called it Heartbreak Hotel. Mm-hmm. Against my better judgment, which I'm glad I lost that argument because our marketing people were saying, oh, no, the group sales people love it. And I was going, who would name a business Heartbreak? But it worked. It worked.
Y'all have also just added all kinds of buildings and shops and restaurants across the street. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the whole new visitor complex for years, and we did well for many, many years with our little repurposed strip shopping mall that was our visitor complex. But we finally built kind of the dream property, and it's, to put it in perspective, the old little center was about 40,000 square feet, and the new complex is 220,000 square feet. And it's got a whole what we always wanted to do, an Elvis the Entertainer exhibit, separate from what was in the trophy building at the house. And, of course, a new car museum and new restaurants and new exhibits. And it's, and of course, what's becoming very popular is, and we called it the soundstage. We wanted to build, and it's 20,000 square foot. It's just a big black box with dark curtains that, Jay, you'd appreciate the acoustics. It's actually pretty good for a big black box. And it's allowing us to do, you know, branch out, do concerts. And we kind of, it seems like there's the coming wave is comedians. I'm hearing a lot of potential comedians that we may host, and which is obviously just casting a wider net and bringing, you know, people who, and I'll tell you what else it's doing. It's bringing Memphians who think, I don't know, that think Whitehaven is far, far away, et cetera. And they, when they find out it's a 12-minute drive, they...
Well, and then they go and they see how nice it is. It's a beautiful complex. Yeah. And I've been to concerts there. It's well done. And the restaurants are good. It's a great experience,
yeah,
is what it is.
No, it is succeeding. You know, in other words, the original grounds of Graceland, when I came on the scene in 81, 82, Graceland was 13 and a half acres. And Vernon had bought an 11-acre piece across the street. And it, you know, and it's interesting. I've got aerial photographs taken when Elvis bought Graceland, and it's all farmland all around it. And he could have bought everything in the photo with the proceeds from one song. And we spent 25 years and probably $45 million buying up all this land. But our campus is 120 acres now, which gives us, back to kind of wish list, it gives us plenty of room to grow.
So it's a remarkable journey of what you've built over time. But looking backwards, were there any struggles? Were there any potential failures along the way?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about that because I've heard Pearson ask this question before. And it's interesting because the biggest mistake, most costly mistake, was the restaurant nightclub downtown, Elvis Presley's Memphis. And the mistake was on a couple of levels. One was it was too nice. And there was an expectation, even from our audience, our hundreds of thousands of visitors, they want Beale Street, in our opinion, to be gritty. You know.
And it mostly is.
And it is. No, and I, you know, I love Tommy Peters, but I've always said it's a good thing you don't have to turn on the lights at B.B. King's because it's, and it was, I mean, because B.B.'s, I've envied B.B. King's all along. It's just that perfect balance of good food and funky atmosphere and grit.
It's a well-loved establishment.
No, it really is.
It is.
And there's a whole bunch of them. Yeah. You know, the Blue City and all. Beale Street, and it'll be back. The crowds will be back. But the kind of the important lesson about the mid-90s were just boom time for tourism in Memphis and for us. And I spent way too much money building Elvis Presley's Memphis. And in other words, it was a very costly failure. But looking back, the lesson I feel, it was a very good time for tourism. We were flush with cash. And it makes me think back to your question, Jay, that I kind of think we made the most costly mistakes, pretty much aligned with looking back the times when we had the most money to spend. And when we had leaner times, you know, mini recessions, et cetera, or we were expanding. But the point is, when money was tight, it seems like we came up with our best ideas, executed our best additions, and et cetera. And it's, I don't know why, maybe it's a personal lesson that it's having too much money to spend. For us, it limited periods of creativity.
Well, I think that the pandemic is also kind of a good example of the things that you've had to create during a time. I mean, who would have thought Elvis Week would have been able to go successfully virtually? And y'all did that. Can you talk some about that?
Sure. Well, it's been let's face it, it's been a challenge for everybody. We closed around March 20th for about 9 weeks, got back open under this local guidelines. And it's interesting that we, you know, in other words, the tours that ordinarily can run at 300 and something, 380 people an hour, et cetera, were limited to groups of 10 separated by 10 minutes and, you know, something like 70 people an hour. And of course, the restaurants were, you know, limited capacity. But we were able to get back open in March, April, May and bring as many employees back as we could. And it's interesting because, honestly, you know, in blogs and around the world, in the fan world, the word got out that it was a great time to visit Graceland because it was practically like a private tour. And, you know, and so in a way, they kept coming. And we just started, as a matter of fact, taking advantage of Angie Marchese, who heads up our archives group and is an absolute human encyclopedia of Elvis information and just has a great way about her. And we've started these virtual behind-the-scenes tours live with Angie, streaming, and, you know, it limited to 250 people, and they're selling out. And it's live and it's streaming and they can ask questions and Angie can answer them. And in other words, adversity is the mother of invention. And it's a really intimate, it's a very cool application of the new streaming technology. And the other thing is, it's not just people you can't get here. In a lot of instances, it's people that will maybe never get here. They're in Australia and they're in Africa and they're all over Europe. And these virtual tours live, they get up, you know, it could be 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning where they are, and they get up. And anyway, it's very successful, very.
And it doesn't have to end even when Graceland's back up to 320 people an hour.
Exactly.
It can go on forever.
You know, once again, Somebody I was talking yesterday was asking about, you know, how to do it, come up with to get more visitors to Graceland, et cetera, and like to get people to come back. And I said, you know, remember, we've had 22 million visitors, and that's just a fraction of the 300 million people in the country that we hope to get part of. And finding new ways. The virtual tours are a hit and they're going to stay because so many of the attendees, they're in Europe.
Yeah, what is the breakdown of the 22 million that have come versus domestic versus international?
Traditionally, I mean, the answer pre-COVID, of course, pre-20 and everything else has always been 20 to 23% outside the country.
Okay.
Which is a real high percentage for Tennessee tourism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, I can remember with Bill Haslam, the governor, in one of the first meetings when we met a number of years ago, we had some representatives from the far, you know, Tennessee is like three states. There's us in the West, there's Middle Tennessee, Nashville country, and then there's East, the Blue Mountains, you know, Blue Ridge Mountains, and et cetera. And, you know, but asked, he said, Jack, you know, foreign tourism, and I said, it's 20, 23%. And turned to Ted Miller, the president of Dolly Parton Productions, and said, and how about, you know, the Tri-Cities? And he went, I don't know, maybe 1%. You know, because they're very much about a 300-mile, three audience, and the people with the kayaks strapped to the top of their cars and et cetera. But we're a very unique draw.
Yeah, that's one thing about Memphis music in general is that it's so much appreciated outside of the U.S. and Elvis would be included in that as well.
Yeah, Jay, you know that more than anybody from what you've been in, because, you know, we always have said that the people, we host people all day, every day that know more about Memphis music and the Delta and the blues influence and et cetera than all of Memphis put together.
Right. Do you have people applying for jobs from outside of the U.S.?
Yes. Yeah, we do. And it's interesting. It's just interesting.
Yeah.
That there are, and we love that. I mean, there are people all over the world who write us and say, it would be my dream to work at Graceland. And
people are always encouraged to pursue their passion. And this is a real passion for a lot of people.
Yeah. Right? No, you know, way back in the 80s when we did the tour with the tour guides before the iPad tour, the word had kind of gotten around, supposedly, that if you were an Elvis fan, don't say so in the interview because we wouldn't hire Elvis fans. And the thread behind that story was every once in a while, there really would be such an avid Elvis fan that if a guest made a little joke or anything else, they couldn't control themselves. They'd get all defensive. And we'd go, no, you can't do that.
Customer's always right.
But passionate is just fun. And then there's the conversion rate. We've got lots of young people that came to work at Graceland because they just needed a job. And they've become fans. And they've become friends with fans. And, and they tell us it changed my life stories. So
that's great. So it's a remarkable journey to have started with just this very, very aspirational goal and achieve so much of it. I know you've had to learn skills and come up with processes and ideas over time. How have you taught yourself to be successful as you are?
Fortunately, it works. I'm glad it works because I couldn't do it any other way. I'm kind of basically try to find the people with the imagination and the creativity and the skills and get them on board. And then for God's sakes, leave them alone and let them be creative and let them succeed. So it's like, I'm kind of like the old saying about my name, Jack of all trades and master of none. I love the idea of putting together a team of people who have creative gifts far beyond mine, and together kind of collaboratively come up with new ideas and better directions to go. But, I had that conversation not long. I 30-something years, I don't really remember giving an order or a command, in the conduct of our business. It's just always been so much collaboration, and we've had great people. We've got some. And they kid sometimes about longevity. We've got a lot of 25 and 30 and 35-year employees.
That's great. How do you find the people that, as they're starting, how do you find your best people?
Well, HR would say sites where they post job openings and et cetera, et cetera. We'd like to try to be accessible internally because it really is. There's some of those kids that came because they needed a job, kind of fell in love with the culture and want to do more and want to be more. And then there's the people who have heard or believe that working at Graceland would be fun and interesting. And we don't have some magic program.
Did you have any mentors that as you were growing this, anybody that was, because it's not really that there's any, I guess you could talk to the people that were running Biltmore, but did you have any other mentors that kind of helped you along the way?
Well, back to my story about going and visiting all the famous homes and presidential libraries and the Smithsonian and et cetera, and getting great advice from many people. The closest would be when I visited with the Smithsonian. It was interesting. They were asking for an Elvis jumpsuit for the exhibit at the Museum of American History, where they have Archie's chair and Fonzie's jacket and the ruby slippers. And I talked them out of that. But in the process, met an exhibit director, creator at the Smithsonian named Ben Lawless, who stayed a dear friend until he passed away here a few years ago. And that would be the closest thing to somebody that I could go to time and time again and bounce ideas off. And, he could walk into a room of stuff. And at Graceland, we have rooms of stuff because Elvis's dad and his manager were both pack rats. But, he could walk into a warehouse, literally our archives of just stuff. And he just had the perfect eye for going, you ought to put that on display and that on display and that on display and use these three things to tell this story and that story, because that's what artifacts at the end of the day are, tools to tell the story. And I learned a lot from him. And also I miss him because his ideas sometimes were so far outside the box, you couldn't even see the box. And it was fun to have a creative friend like that.
Do you have a favorite archive or a favorite room at Graceland that just makes you happy? Is there anything that's special?
I think over the years, the halls of gold, the gold and platinum record, there was something just kind of fun. I don't know about over the years, another phenomenon, Graceland, Elvis really was a star. I mean, it just the list is pages and pages of celebrities who have visited Graceland. And it's particularly, and Jay, you could relate to this, it's the ones that know what's involved in a gold or platinum record. You know, in other words, they know how hard they worked and how much sweat they put into getting a gold record. And it, just seeing them just kind of awestruck, going, I can remember early on the Beach Boys were in town and they had quite a pretty good number of gold records themselves, but they were just speechless at Elvis. And it was, so I think there's something, I guess, on behalf, kind of gratifying for Elvis that, you know, to watch people's reaction.
How many of them are there? How many gold and platinum records are there? Do you have any idea?
No, I've lost track. It's like 180, 200, and then it gets obscured. The numbers get obscured anyway, the way the RIAA counts and, you know, in looking at the evolution of, they actually were records that they dipped in whatever. And there's 180, 200 to something. And sometimes there's gold records that went gold and then they went platinum and they went double platinum.
So, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Elvis has the most number of records sold. Is that correct?
Yes. And that is, in other words, a lot of it can't and will never be and was not certifiable by the RIAA in the 50s. But RCA, that basically was economically incentivized not to report all the sales. Basically, you know, that's in short order in 56, 57. They gave him an award for 50 million records sold. And like less than a year later, they gave him a television with a plaque on it, an RCA television that commemorated 75 million records. And those are all sales that really have never been accounted for. But anyway, the number that used to be kind of agreed upon was something like 1.3, 1.4 billion records worldwide.
How do they even count that anymore? Because now it'd be streaming and everything else. I mean, there's really no way to count that anymore.
It's lost its relatability. Because now, you're absolutely right. I mean, you see these incredible numbers for streaming. Hundreds of millions of streams of a Taylor Swift song or whatever.
And tens of pennies.
Yes.
Well, the royalties have changed dramatically.
No, that exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like, it was just yesterday if we were in the loop with some of the stuff, like I say, that we still had a say. But, you know, when an album sold for $15 to $17 and you wanted a dollar $50, $75 royalty. And if somebody had said, how about a penny?
Yeah. It is crazy. It's definitely changing, isn't it?
So I'd be curious to know, were there any ideas that you considered that after considering them, you said, nah, that's never going to work?
Oh, Lord, I'm sure there were many.
Yeah.
I'm trying to, maybe historical amnesia, I've gotten them out of my mind.
That's actually a good answer.
Yeah, no, I really don't, one doesn't come to mind, but there were, you know, once again, I referred to even Ben Lawless and having people on our team that are invited and encouraged to think outside the box, as they say. You know, that means there were a lot of ideas that would get thrown up that probably, well, the fact that we don't have a whole lot of incredibly expensive mistakes other than our downtown restaurant, et cetera, means that we put the brakes on some of them. One that certainly changed and evolved, and the question comes up sometimes, is Elvis impersonators. And basically, they, as a kind of an industry, not us, kind of started calling themselves Elvis tribute artists, which is more sophisticated. And our observation, we went from kind of keeping, I used to call it 80s, early 90s, benign neglect, you know, was to dress up and act like somebody else is a First Amendment right. So we just stayed out of it. And for the most part, you know, I'd always used to say in the 80s that Elvis impersonators that would come around and wear jumpsuits and, you know, that I'd kind of say Elvis impersonators don't ever seem to look like Elvis, but they all look like each other.
Yeah.
and there was that look. But it what evolved with, I think, with more entertainment outlets in Las Vegas and around the country and the gaming industry, et cetera, there just we started increasingly becoming aware of really some really talented, very professional young men who had spent a great deal of time really perfecting the details of an Elvis performance. And so we kind of went from benign neglect to here, it's, I think it's been 12, 14, 16 years ago. We literally, like, I guess it was the old Pogo cartoon, you know, find a parade and jump in front of it. And the impersonator, ETA area was just growing and growing. And that parade was not going to go away. So we got in front of it and created the annual Ultimate Elvis Tribute Artist Contest. We have about 25 or 30 contests around the world, in Europe and Australia and America. And every August, those winners come and compete for the Ultimate Elvis Tribute. And they get a contract with Legends in Concert and a check for $25,000, et cetera. But the transition was, these are really, really professional, really dedicated young men that kind of represents a bona fide discovery point for young people now that just didn't exist at all 20 years ago.
That is amazing, isn't it? That he's still, I mean, he's died such a long time ago, and there are people that still want to dress up and perform like him. It's just amazing, and there's just nobody like him.
Well, and as a matter of fact, I mean, we've got just coming up here in a couple of weeks at Graceland, they call it the ETA weekend. It's one of our first, and it's socially distanced and the, you know, et cetera, performances. And the soundstage that ordinarily seats like 1,700 people is socially distanced, laid out. The maximum to the formula is we can do 464, I think, 470 seats, all spread out in the 20,000. And there are performances by ETAs on Friday and Saturday night, and they're all sold out, you know. There's once again, and it gets me back to that walking around asking young people how they became a fan. And it's incredible that didn't really exist 20 years ago. And now they'll say, well, you know what? I was out with my friends one night. We went to this nightclub, or we went to this bar, and they were having an Elvis tribute artist contest. And I never even thought about it. I thought it was kind of a goofy thing. And, you know, and they say, and, you know, and 3 hours later, we were dancing on the table and I was an Elvis fan. And so I'd kind of go, they're a discovery point, and their dedication to doing it well is paying off for us.
One of the questions we always like to ask in the podcast is, has Memphis been especially important to you in growing your business? And obviously, you couldn't do
everything
that
yeah.
anywhere else. But what excites you about Memphis right now?
Oh, I think that Memphis is starting, you know, I heard years ago, this was in the 80s, I remember hearing someone make the statement that Memphis was a town with a great future and always will be. And I, you know, and I, it was a cynical notion, you know, that Memphis is not going to kind of get its aggregate values together. And watching that happen, and it has through some great leadership politically and business leadership and commitment, and, you know, in the blessing that some of the greatest entrepreneurs in the world, the Kimmins Wilson, the Fred Smith, Pitt Hyde, you know, that created huge businesses that sometimes I think in part wouldn't have happened on either coast, needed to kind of be central. But there's a can-do, there's a sense of opportunity in Memphis. I think Memphis just has a great future.
Well said. Yes, I totally agree, too.
Another thing we always ask our interviewees is, do you think that entrepreneurship can be taught, or is it something innate, something that you're born with?
I don't know. The answer must be both. It's, you know, a certain attraction to adventure and risk, and it's, you know, part personal. And then it seems like, I don't know. I mean, I remember early my stockbroker days, because I was a terrible stockbroker. The market. I really thank God Elvis came along.
Yeah.
But it was, I read a lot of books that were even some of the classics at the time, the Dale Carnegie, and I remember reading, stuck in my head, Psycho-Cybernetics, written by a plastic surgeon about transforming your self-image. And so some of that's teachable, or all those self-help management books wouldn't have maybe have been as successful as they were. But it was, in my case, let's face it, it was just an amazing amount of luck. Being in the right place at the right time, in retrospect, with the right disposition. Because I know it seems like all through the 80s I wore pinstripe suits. And I'd have meetings. I'd go to, we opened an office in LA, and we had music publishing in New York. And I'd go to meetings, and they'd start with people kind of shaking their head and going, "You're not what I expected." You know, from Elvis Entertainment, and I'd go, "What did you expect? They've got gold chains, open shirt." So it worked to have a kind of a different perspective. And that was just luck.
Well, what do you see 10 years from now? What kind of luck? What will Graceland, what will it look like?
Well, hopefully the answer is just as I said it was all along. If the business isn't vibrant, then it's my fault. It's our fault. We didn't make the changes, the adjustments, etc. And yet by the same token, and maybe I just because, you know, like when you've been involved in one thing as long as I have, I think there's a balance point between, what do I want to say? I think an kind of overworked and over-glorified notion is disruption. Because there, I mean, great, you know, obvious, incredible disruptions, but there's also needs to be balanced with not making changes for change's sake. Seems logical to me to keep the best of what's working, and then back to always be afraid of being left behind, being afraid of making the wrong decisions. So really thinking it over, and that's, so hopefully we're doing that and we'll do that. You know, there's an authenticity. You go up on the hill where Graceland is. I mean, for all of the big soundstage across the street and the high tech and the interactive games and all kinds of things, at the heart of it, the reason over 500,000, 600,000 people a year still come to Graceland is walking through the front door of that house. There's just something so authentic about it and so real. And without it, we'd be another music museum someplace.
Yeah. Can you tell us a story about Paul Simon and his song called Graceland?
Well, yeah. Paul Simon, we were aware, it's like he's one of those celebrities, as I said earlier. We have just an incredible list of people, of celebrities that have visited Graceland. And some of the neatest stories are the ones that didn't send a publicist ahead of time and arrange security and, you know, we're going to need free tickets for the entourage. And Paul Simon was one of them that, you know, one of the tour guides recognized him and did what they were taught to do, which is, "Excuse me, are you Paul Simon?" And he said, "Yes." And they were taught to say, "Is there anything we can do for you? Otherwise, have a nice day. You know, don't ask for their autograph. Don't." So we knew he had toured. Then we heard he had this album coming. We knew he had recorded a song about traveling and coming to Graceland, even though the album itself was going to be mostly the new, those amazing African rhythms that he produced. And it coincided with the first year of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. at the Waldorf, and I was there. Elvis was the first inductee, and George Klein and I accepted it on behalf of Elvis. The presenters were John Lennon's two sons. But George Klein, amazing George Klein, he knew everybody. It was amazing, you know, that one way or another. We were standing around, the banquet was, everybody was on their feet. And George called me over and he introduced me to Paul Simon. He said, Paul's got a question. And he said, I visited Graceland. I said, I heard. I hope it was great. He said, wrote a song. He said, I'd like to name the whole album Graceland. Do you have a problem with that? And I said, no, how can I help? You know, so it was standing there like at a cocktail party with drinks in your hand that I was like heard about the song and the album and et cetera. And it was wonderful. It's kind of an anthem about, it is. And you know, an interesting, just speaking of people who just stood in line, bought a ticket and went on tour. Another one that comes to mind, there were many, was Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan all by himself showed up one day and the same thing. We knew it because one of the tour guides recognized him. That's just that cool factor that we couldn't possibly have created that. Only Elvis Presley could have created a legacy that would make Bob Dylan stand in line. Anyway.
Well, wow. When I toured Graceland, I was here in Memphis with REM making a record. And the band had gone to Graceland. And they didn't wait in line. They got like,
sure.
You know,
no, don't get me wrong.
Cut in front through the back door, and they had a private tour.
Sure.
When they came back to the studio and they told me and their guitar guy, their roadie, whose name was Microwave, oh, you guys got to go. So we go tomorrow, you know, we'll set up the tour for you. So me and Microwave go the next day. We get to cut in line, go through the VIP door or whatever. And our tour guide tells us on the front end, you know, you may see some fans while you're here and they may want some autographs. And so you can stop and take a picture with them, or you can just say, no, it's up to you. And me and Microwave are looking at each other like, okay,
all right,
that's never going to happen.
That's
but
funny.
We had a great time.
Good. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we just have a little kind of special place for the ones, but you know, it's, and sometimes, you know, it was only here 3-4 years ago that Paul McCartney finally, after being in town several times, toured with his wife, Nancy. And frankly, it was because the day before his band had come out. And I guess they went back and raved about it and said, you've got to go. So, yeah, no, we've loved it. And that gets back to our employees. You know, they love being able to go home and tell their friends that they help, you know, welcome whoever, the latest celebrity in town. So,
right. Well, tell us something about you personally. What do you like to do for fun when you're not running Graceland?
You know, it's like I had either the good luck or the bad luck not to take up golf. And it seems like my life has been just very happily spent. This job, this business we have is so 24/7 and so immersive that it's like a hobby. It's always been like a hobby. And so there's no, you know, there's no other special, you know, hang gliding or something that I should have a more interesting life. But it's,
I think you have a pretty interesting life,
yeah,
honestly.
It's been just an awful lot of fun, so.
Well, I think this has just been a great interview. It makes me so, I'm so proud that every time I've ever been in any other city, any other country, and I say I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and somebody says, have you been to Graceland? Every single time. And I bet that there's not anybody from another city that has that one thing that really stands out as you travel.
Yeah, it is unique. And we've always wanted to be part of a fabric as opposed, you don't want to be the only reason people come to Memphis, and we're not now. I mean, there's Beale Street, and there's all kinds of, and there's barbecue, which is obviously famous. So I've always wanted to be part of a successful fabric as opposed to a glaringly alone thread. So, but it is unique. And you know, as you can imagine, it's been kind of fun to travel, and I have, thanks to Elvis, all over the world, to be in I can remember we made a presentation to Mitsubishi Real Estate in Tokyo once about a Elvis Town USA exhibit we wanted to do. And through the interpreter, this vice president kind of wanted to, he was trying to tell us that nobody in Japan knew who Elvis was and et cetera, et cetera. And he was just trying to blow us off kind of. And we went down and we got in a cab. And I was sitting in the cab and I was sitting next to the driver and I was just going, that guy's just wrong. And I looked at the cab driver and I said, do you speak English at all? And he was, no, and everything else. And, you know, and I said, Memphis, USA, Memphis. And he didn't know and et cetera, et cetera. And I said, Elvis. He goes, ah, Elvis Graceland, and starts singing Elvis songs, like by syllable.
Which would, yep.
And I just went, I'd like to go back to Mitsubishi and take this guy with me.
A lot of people probably learned English by singing Elvis songs.
And we love our Japanese fan clubs. And, you know, and one of our most unique visitors, in fact, was the Japanese prime minister, Koizumi. That was in 06. But the White House, George Bush, wanted to do something for the prime minister because he was retiring from that role. And the White House said, well, what would be the perfect gift? And Peggy Savage, our company, said, well, the perfect gift for an Elvis fan is to take him to Graceland. So sure enough, Bush and Koizumi came and toured Graceland. And it was, you know, and we still have all that. Believe me, they know who Elvis is in Japan.
Well, we are lucky to have you and Graceland and everything in Memphis, Tennessee. So thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
For sure, for sure. If somebody wanted to learn more about Elvis or Graceland, where should they go?
Oh, graceland.com. You can go in every direction from just graceland.com. Elvis.com will get you there too.
Great. Well, thank you again. We really, really appreciate you doing this.
No, listen, I'm the luckiest guy in the world, and it just because Elvis... As I've always said, Elvis made us all look smarter than we were.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We hope that you've enjoyed our conversation with Jack Soden. If you'd like to learn more about Jack or Graceland or Elvis, please visit our show notes.
Thanks for listening to Entrepreneurial Insights. If you enjoyed this conversation, feel free to share with your friends or colleagues. You can find more episodes or subscribe anywhere that you listen to your favorite podcasts. And of course, reviews are always welcome and appreciated. You can also check us out online at entrepreneurialinsightspodcast.com or bluffcitybusiness.com.